We're about to talk about Stokely, Stokely a Life, the life of Stokely Carmichael. Peniel Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts, has written this book. He's written these incredible books before, Waiting Till the Midnight Hour and Dark Days, Bright Nights. And he is here now to talk to us about Stokely a Life. And Peniel, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thank you for having me, Mark.
So this is tell me, first of all, this sounds in some ways, I've read your other books, this is almost a little bit of a labor of love, kind of looking at Stokely. Had a lot to do with you and your growing up, right?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in a very political household in New York City, the proud son of Haitian immigrants, and was raised by a single mother who was a hospital worker for 40 years at in New York City, local 1199. And, you know, I was on my first picket line in elementary school. So movements for social political justice were always more personal than just academic for me.
You know, the people who do remember Stokely Carmichael, when people look at him in history, and now it's so funny to think about that, is history, but it's history. It's very one-dimensional. It's black power.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? He's viewed as sort of this angry young man whose call for black power really helped explode the civil rights movement, really helped start, you know, the end of King's beloved community. And if anything, he's actually a part of that same civil rights movement that people are saying he helped explode. And he's just a much more complicated, richly complex figure than just black power. But in our contemporary context, he's just been relegated to sort of the angry young man who shouted black power and then left for Africa.
But let's talk about the complexity, because, I mean, that was it. But there's so much more than that. I mean, when you start this book off, talk about his growing up in New York, coming from Trinidad, this whole part of his life that deeply shaped him as a teenager and a boy in New York, and living in a white neighborhood and getting into Bronx Science High, and tell that story. And that's amazing, because the things that shape us as young kids.
Yeah, definitely. Stokely's story is really the story of an immigrant, because he is coming to the United States 2 weeks before his 11th birthday. He grew up in Port of Spain, Trinidad, you know, up until, you know, fifth, sixth grade. And he is surrounded by these strong black women in Trinidad. He's raised really by his maternal grandmother and some aunts. And he's raised relatively, you know, middle class in Trinidad as well. You know, he goes to a local school where he, you know, gets dressed up, and there's a dress code. And he's a big reader. He's hyper literate. So by the time he comes to the United States, he already has a very specific sort of self-confidence and feeling of who he is. So when he comes, basically they very quickly move to Morris Park, the Carmichaels. His father, Adolphus, is a carpenter by trade, but becomes really a man of all seasons in New York City, a taxi cab driver doing different itinerant labor just to make ends meet. And his mother, May Charles, and that's what he calls her affectionately, May Charles, never mom, is really a fireball who teaches him a very big sense of what's right, what's wrong, and he really takes after her temperamentally. So within the context, and he has four sisters, couple older, a couple younger, and he's the middle child. So within the context of New York City, he then, you know, is really introduced to race relations in New York, and he is so bright and so both intellectually but also a fire plug himself, he quickly acclimates in whatever environment he's in. So he really grows up in dual worlds. One is a African-American, Caribbean, Pan-Africanist world of going to Harlem to get haircuts and listen to street speakers. But then there's another world where, I mean, locally he joins what he calls the Morris Park Dukes, a local little gang, all white except for him.
Right, all Italian kids except for him, right?
All Italian kids, and they give him the nickname Cici,
right,
you know,
right.
For Siciliano.
Because he's dark.
You know, they're dark-skinned paisan. But then there's also the intellectual side, Bronx Science, entering that in 1956, and that's a school you have to test into, and he tests into Bronx Science before affirmative action. He's one of only about eight black kids out of 300 that graduate in the class of 1960, including people like journalist Jeff Greenfield and others, real luminaries. He becomes best friends with Gene Dennis Jr., who's the son of a high-ranking communist official. So these are the sons and daughters of liberals and lefties who he becomes really good friends with. So he's attending reading circles where they're reading about radical political economy. They're reading Marxism, socialism. He's marching in pro-Israel marches in the 1950s. So New York City is very, very important. He first meets up Bayard Rustin, the most right. famous black social democrat in the country at the time, in the 1950s. So, you know, and when he finds out who that is, you know, he says that, you know, he felt Rustin walked and talked with so much confidence he might as well have had a cape on. He was Superman for Stokely's set. And Stokely said, this is who I want to be. So it's very interesting that he's organizing garment workers in the 1950s, but he's also organizing in Harlem with black kids. So he's an incredibly complicated figure. And he's, unlike some of his compatriots in SNCC, he's not politicized by the sit-in demonstrations. He's already political. So all the sit-in demonstrations do for him when he finds out about them in the winter of 1960, they give him another context to apply and amplify his own politics. So Stokely was marching with people who were part of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in right. 1959 and 1960. So that's who he is. So it's a really complicated political genealogy and a very rich one.
And Bayard Rustin was huge in his growing up, as well as his. You wrote about his trips to Harlem with his father to get his hair cut, and how going to this all black world from his neighborhood really had an effect on him as well. The men he met there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he becomes somebody who imbibes and learns about black American culture because he's from Trinidad. He's 14 years old when Emmett Till is assassinated,
right.
for instance, when Emmett Till is lynched, same age as Stokely. And he's listening to people talk about it and debate what's going on, you know. So he's getting these examples of black heroism through not just reading about Montgomery bus boycott and Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, but also the anti-colonial movements, because between 1957 and 62, there's going to be about 25 different African nation states that achieve independence. And so names like Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré and Nnamdi Azikiwe, these are floating off of people's mouths in Harlem. And Stokely becomes part of that. And, you know, even culturally, you know, he works at his uncle's record shop. He's listening to world music, African music, Miriam Makeba in the 1950s and listening to jazz. So he's very interested in culture and the global culture of black people. Again, as a teenager, so he's hugely precocious, hugely intellectual, but also activist oriented.
I mean, he heard Miriam Makeba, and he was a kid, he told his sisters, "I'm going to marry her."
Yeah, he did. He does, you know. And you know what's interesting, Mark, about Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture is one of the interesting parts about diving into his life was how preternaturally confident he was. So he was somebody who. It's not just the Miriam Makeba, but it's like, you know, if he's going to say, you know, segregation, we need to stop that, or voting rights, we need to get that, or we need to help poor black sharecroppers get political power in Mississippi and Alabama. Not only would he do it, he really thought it was going to happen eventually, just through organizing and sort of his sheer ability, his sheer political will to make it happen. So he's really hugely, hugely confident.
So when he goes to Howard University... he goes there for lots of reasons he chose to go to Howard.
Yeah, he goes to Howard because that's a conscious choice.
Right,
and what's interesting
right.
about that is that Stokely Carmichael, even though we sort of identify him as black power and black nationalist and he marries Miriam Makeba, but, you know, he says, even in his autobiography, you know, he dated white girls at Bronx Science. He's very comfortable in the white world. He's very comfortable in the black world. I mean, he's somebody who could have gone to Harvard University, he could have gone to the Ivy League and not just fit in and competed, but really led and thrived. And he purposely chooses to be in that black world because that's where his heart is, right? And so, you know, Howard is a conscious choice, but because of the segregation of the 1960s, Howard has a better contingent of black intellectuals and really just intellectuals, period, than its Ivy League counterpart. So you're talking about a school that has E. Franklin Frazier, You're talking about a school that has Sterling Brown, Toni Morrison,
who is his teacher,
freshman English class. I mean, so it's an amazing, amazing. You know, the way in which Howard was the faculty there from the 1930s up until the 60s. I mean, I don't think there's really any university in the United States that had that kind of distinguished faculty, irrespective of race.
No question. I mean, they didn't call it the Black Harvard for nothing.
Yeah, and I think even calling it the Black Harvard, in a way, is too condescending, because I think that, you know, the intellectuals that it had there in that same historic time period, because this is a pre, you know, Afro-American studies at Harvard and Dream Team at Harvard. This is Harvard where, you know, basically no black people have tenure, you know, all these different things. So Howard had a huge, eclectic array of brilliant, prodigious, prolific scholars. And he takes advantage of that, and he also takes advantage of the fact that his fellow students at Howard are really, really brilliant. And the students who are part of the Nonviolent Action Group, people like Mike Thelwell and Cortland Cox and so many different others, Ed Brown, really, you know, he learns from them as much as they learn from him. So Howard becomes a little lab experiment in further organizing. So he organizes in Washington, D.C. He's organizing along Route 40. He meets Malcolm X in 1961. So Howard is very, very important.
It's huge. And I want to get to that. I mean, because he was a civil rights worker in the state that I am interviewing you from at this moment. I mean, he was in Cambridge, Maryland. He was on the Freedom Ride in Route 40. He was the Nonviolent Action Group at Howard University. He was an integral part of and a leader of was a huge force in the civil rights movement in this area. And he was in the middle of it all.
Yeah, he was really in the middle of it all. And NAG is one of the headquarters, Nonviolent Action Group, of SNCC. So SNCC has several headquarters in terms of the Nashville group in Atlanta, but then NAG is really the militant nonviolent activist. So they are involved in everything from tenants' rights activism. Like you said, they're in the Route 40 protests, and Route 40, you know, runs along Maryland, you know, D.C., other parts, and the segregated restaurants that were there, they're protesting against that. They're part of the group of activists who are going into Cambridge, Maryland, which is a huge site of protest, 1963, 64, 62, led by Gloria Richardson and CNAC, the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee. So it's really a rich, rich time. One of the things I discovered doing the research is that, you know, Stokely testified before a civil rights subcommittee in March of 1963, and that was because the Howard University gymnasium was being built with no African American labor, and they made that happen. The Howard Hilltop, the newspaper, is very, very instrumental here. So, you know, Howard becomes this huge, huge site. You know, there's great stories of Stokely, you know, picketing Bobby Kennedy in the Attorney General's office and with NAG. So they are fearless. They are picketing, you know, different parts of the federal government because of racial segregation. And, you know, Mississippi looms large here because every summer Stokely goes down to Mississippi. I think one of the most unremembered aspects of Stokely Carmichael is that he was a freedom rider.
Right.
He's arrested June 8, 1961. So was John Lewis. They spend time in prison together. So you think about Stokely Carmichael and you don't think, wow, you know, his first arrest in 1961 is as a freedom rider. And he spends, you know, about 40 days in jail, including Mississippi's worst prison farm, Parchman Penitentiary, where he had heard about Parchman in the village as a teenager when people were singing folk songs about Parchman.
Right. And also there's something that's really fascinating here is this deep relationship that he had with Martin Luther King. I think most people don't know about this. I mean, you kind of trace it all the way through the book, through up to King's assassination. And you trace this bond that these two men had, even when people thought they should hate each other. I mean, talk about that from the beginning. This relationship with King was very complex.
Yeah, Stokely Carmichael always loves Martin Luther King Jr., and I think that belies popular conceptions of who he is and who both men were. They first meet at Howard University in 1963. And Stokely is so confident, he always thinks and knows in his heart and mind he's headed for big things. So unlike other SNCC activists, probably most notably James Forman and others, he doesn't criticize King and he doesn't get upset when King upstages his own activism and his own work. So when he's going into Mississippi, Alabama, and people say, "Are you one of Dr. King's men?" He says, "Yes, I am." So he's very, very interested. And he's not interested in imitating King, too. So we think about John Lewis, and John Lewis, chairman of SNCC and now congressman, a wonderful, courageous hero, but certainly very much influenced by Dr. King and Dr. King's manner and his speech, where Stokely is very, very much an independent organizer. But they meet in 63 for the first time. By 64, Stokely is chauffeuring King in Greenwood, Mississippi, during the summer project in June, and they spend about 6 days together. In 65, Stokely is marching with King during the Selma demonstrations, but Stokely goes into Lowndes County along with people like Judy Richardson and Bob Mance and other SNCC activists to organize independent politics, Lowndes County Freedom Organization, with a local movement led by John Hewlett that becomes nicknamed the Black Panther Party.
Right.
But it's really 66 during the Meredith March that friendship really deepens. So they spend about 3 weeks together during the Meredith March Against Fear after James Meredith, who's the first student to integrate the University of Mississippi in 62, he's shot and injured on his one-man march to Jackson. And King and Stokely and other civil rights leaders vow to continue that march and register people in Mississippi along the way. And that's where Stokely unleashes the Black Power phrase, June 16, 1966. But he really comes to see a very, very deep side of King. So they march side by side. They're sleeping overnight in the same camp at times. And they really come to have a deep friendship. And obviously Stokely's iconography emerges after that march. And so they see each other quite frequently. One of the things I talk about in the book is the April 15th, 1967
mobilization
spring
against the
mobilization.
War. Right.
And that's the biggest anti-war demonstration in American history up until that time. 400,000 people, the United Nations. It starts at the Sheep's Meadow in Central Park.
Right.
And it's really Stokely and King. And Stokely speaks before King, but really steals the show, calling the war in Vietnam a racist war, an imperialist war. You see Stokely's anti-imperialism. But afterwards, at MLK, MLK and Stokely have a discussion at Harry Belafonte's sprawling New York City apartment. Belafonte owned an apartment that was about 18 rooms large in New York City. And Stokely's teasing Dr. King because King had just come out against the war 11 days earlier at Riverside Church in New York. And he's saying that his own activism is pushing King further to the left. And what's interesting about that is that 2 weeks later, King actually calls up Stokely in Atlanta. And he says that, "I want you to come to Ebenezer and hear me
right.
preach tomorrow." And Stokely says, "You know, I'm not coming because I'm a good heathen and I'm going to do the people's work." And King really implores him to come. And Stokely says, "Well, why do you want me to come so badly?" And King says, "I'm really coming out against the Vietnam War forcefully." And there's going to be about 30 seconds of silence on the phone. And Stokely says, "Not only am I coming to your church tomorrow, Dr. King, I'm going to be in the front pew of that church tomorrow." And there's this great footage from Eyes on the Prize of after King does that speech last Sunday in April of 1967, Stokely Carmichael, alongside Cleve Sellers, who's one of his best friends and a SNCC activist
right.
in his own right, is leading the standing ovation. So what's interesting is that those two men, they disagree about Black Power, they disagree over violence versus nonviolence, but they have a shared love of Black people and poor people, and they have a shared resistance to the Vietnam War. And the interesting part about doing the research was how big of an anti-Vietnam War activist Stokely Carmichael actually was. And he's the activist who popularizes the chant, "Hell no,
we won't go.
I mean, before Muhammad Ali, before Dr. King,
right.
it's Stokely Carmichael.
See, this is upon the beauty of this thing, the story you're telling, Peniel. I mean, is that, first of all, I never knew... The depth and the intricacy of and the depth of the relationship between King and Carmichael before I read your book, and because I just remember SNCC is the place where people dislike King, as not being forward enough. You know, people joked and called him the Lord and called Abernathy mm-hmm. pork chop. You know what I'm saying? It was a real interesting, really fascinating to read about their relationship, and those two phrases define the '60s: Black Power, Hell No, We Won't Go. And they came out of Stokely Carmichael.
Yeah, I mean, his anti-war activism is part of a deeper anti-imperialist philosophy that one of the set pieces in the biography, Stokely, is Stokely Carmichael in October of 1966 at Berkeley, California. And it's interesting because it's over 10,000 students. The previous week, Robert Kennedy has spoken there. And Stokely delivers this really gorgeous speech about democracy, white privilege, war, race, inequality, and really challenges the students at Berkeley to confront their own white privilege and makes this argument that the reason why democracy isn't working is because we have regular wars in the United States and racial oppression, and there's no way democracy can work that way. And so what's interesting is that SNCC had come out against the war in January of 1966,
right.
But it really takes Stokely Carmichael and the iconography of black power to make SNCC not just its anti-war message, but its really anti-imperialism message. And by anti-imperialism, I mean SNCC's conception of the United States as an empire and Stokely's conception of the United States as an empire, an analog to old British, French imperialism, but different in the sense that there was actually internal colonialism happening in the United States, and also different because the United States had said it was really an empire of freedom, liberty, and democracy, right?
Right.
So what's very, very interesting is that Stokely, even before going off to Puerto Rico and Cuba and Paris and Guinea and Africa, he's talking about anti-imperialism in 1966, and certainly he's talking about it before Martin Luther King Jr., really in that final last year, is really talking about anti-imperialism as well. So it's a very interesting look chronologically when we see who is Stokely Carmichael and how his politics and really the global anti-colonial struggles are shaping his politics. So even before the Black Panthers become this huge group in 1968, Stokely is providing a platform for SDS, for SNCC, for the Panthers, to really internationalize that movement for justice.
You know, and it's also very clear from the book, you know, when you and part of the history, when you describe what SNCC was doing back in the early 60s, mid-60s, and Stokely being in the middle of that, and as a leader of that, one of the leaders of that, that it is also what gave birth to the white resistance movement to the war, came out of the civil rights, came out of the white workers of SNCC.
Absolutely.
There's
a direct lineage. There's a real connection between people like Tom Hayden, Casey Hayden, Students for a Democratic Society, the National Student Association, the NSA, and SNCC. So when we think about the anti-war activism, certainly Bob Moses had spoken out against the war. Malcolm X had talked about Vietnam in 1964. King had talked about Vietnam in 65, but then there's a phone call with LBJ, and President Johnson says, you know, you really have to stop that. You don't want them to divide us on that. And so King stays silent until April of 67. And that's one of King's biggest regrets, is those sort of 2 years of silence. And the people who fill that vacuum in that time, it's really SNCC, you know. And SNCC, again, what's interesting about Stokely, and one thing we haven't talked about is what's Stokely's relationship with white activists.
Right.
And he criticizes white liberalism. He criticizes institutional racism. He never criticizes white people personally. He doesn't feel intimidated or scared or anything negative. He just tells them by 66 they need to be organizing in white communities because the racism is so deep in those communities. But he still provides a platform for white anti-racist activism through that 66 speech. The group that's really going to try to form those coalitions, coalitions that Stokely said could be formed once black people achieve power, is going to be the Black Panther Party, right? They're going to try to form those coalitions with white activists. But Stokely's political activism and his ideas still provide an entree for white radicals in the new left to be part of both the Black Power movement but this wider anti-imperialist struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to come back, work my way back around, but I want to come back to Howard University for a minute because There was another turning point in Stokely's life politically at Howard University when Malcolm X came and Bayard Rustin were there. And to talk a bit about that, I mean, that was a real profound time for him. This is one of the shifts that took place in Stokely.
Yes, definitely. He's 20 years old when he meets Malcolm X, and Malcolm X comes through Project Awareness, which was a project that Howard University students and the NAG and the students Stokely was connected to pursue to bring controversial speakers to campus, and they bring in Malcolm to have a debate with Bayard Rustin on October 30th, 1961. And Stokely says that, you know, as long as he can get a front row seat to the debate, he's going to help them organize it. And he does. And there's a great picture of him in Muhammad Speaks. Young Stokely, you know, very, very thin, in a suit and tie in the front row, you know, gazing upon Malcolm X and Bayard Rustin. And that speech, you know, Malcolm lays out his reasoning and his criteria for really nothing less than a political revolution and really a critique of this idea of coalitions and this idea of democracy that Bayard Rustin is talking about. And so that speech really impacts Howard activists, especially Stokely, because Bayard had been his hero, and he's still going to be his hero for the next few years, but there's going to be real deep doubts that creep in, and certainly after Mississippi Freedom Summer, after the Democratic National Convention and the betrayal at the convention of Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegates, Stokely's going to really reject Rustin's politics. But what's interesting is that black nationalism and Malcolm's idea of self-determination, radical political cultural self-determination, really is going to impact Stokely and SNCC. So we're not going to see the impact until a few years later, but you see the seeds. That is a shifting point. He's going to continue to be a nonviolent organizer, but Malcolm's words are really going to deeply resonate as the 60s progress.
You know, I was thinking about one, and you described this period really well, when Martin Luther King was assassinated and Stokely Carmichael was the chairman, was working in the Washington, D.C., it was in the Washington, D.C. office of SNCC, and trying to you describe him trying to calm the crowds and shut down the businesses and do this nonviolent push, and his own emotional state at the moment. This is another moment for him. I mean, you know, everybody was also lauding up Bobby Kennedy. He was not. John Lewis was off working for Bobby Kennedy, and still he wouldn't have any of it. And even though he and John were close, so I mean, this is another pivotal moment.
Yeah, King's assassination is deeply personal for Stokely, and I think people still haven't come to terms with that, because when we think about these big figures, these iconic figures, there's not an understanding that certain people, you know, knew Dr. King and were friends with Dr. King, right? And Stokely was one of those people fortunate enough to have that relationship. He always says that he always credits Martin Luther King Jr. with teaching him and black people how to face what Stokely described as racial terrorism and racial terror without fear. And so King's death is a real impactful event for Stokely. And you know, 68 is the last full year Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture ever lives in the United States. And so that's a huge, huge impact. I mean, one, he's lost a friend. Two, he becomes more pessimistic and fatalistic about both opportunities for racial equality, economic justice in the United States, but also about his own mortality, because if they can kill King, certainly they can kill him. And so, you know, this is a real, real turning point, and he's going to try to form an alliance with the Black Panther Party, where he's honorary prime minister. But I think that even the term honorary has really been a confusing term, because basically for a little over a year, he serves as prime minister of the Black Panther Party. He's organizing chapters of the Black Panther Party. He's really influencing that group. So the honorary title is misleading. And so when we think about Stokely and King, King's death really pushes him into further development. Like I won't say over the edge, but certainly it's part of his evolution and transformation. And so by the time he leaves for Africa, part of the reason of leaving for Africa is that the United States and the political turmoil in the United States, for him, don't provide a context for the organizing that he thinks is necessary for what he's now determining is a political revolution that's needed to transform the United States.
You know, and one of the things you said in the book, and you just said it again now, which how Stokely thought of Martin Luther King in terms of what he did around racial terrorism. And I think that's a really key point in the sense that people look at King often as this, the person who broke the back of segregation and all the rest, and this, the great civil rights hero. But that is what King really did. King broke the back of racial terrorism. That's what he did.
Yeah, it was racial terrorism. And you know, Stokely, there's a great interview with Stokely as Kwame Ture now in the 1980s. And they're asking about, you know, SNCC and what he experienced. And he says it. He's about 44 years old, 45 years old. He says that SNCC experienced raw terror in the South. And that's one of the things that he said that's always stayed with me, in the sense that, you know, these are activists, some of whom right. are still around, who still have a kind of post-traumatic stress syndrome
yeah.
from what they faced and what they saw, including people dying. I mean, one of Stokely's best friends, who's white, in the movement, Jonathan Daniels is murdered. You know, Sammy Young Jr. is murdered. And this is stuff that we can't quite comprehend for those of us who haven't faced those political times. So the terror that he talks about, racial terrorism, that's what was in the United States in the 1960s. And so when he goes for goes to Africa, he's not exactly fleeing that, but what he's trying to do is establish a political headquarters and base where he can tackle that squarely and head on with the use of state power. He lands in Guinea, West Africa, is connected to Sekou Touré, the president of Guinea, is being mentored by Kwame Nkrumah, who's exiled former president of Ghana, but huge 20th century Pan-Africanist, and he's trying to find a way through these huge leaders who actually have access to institutions to tackle, you know, racism and economic injustice and racial oppression squarely on its face.
And I, you know, that when you talk about the Black Panthers, that was an interesting piece that you wrote. You also kind of very, I mean, in a really good way, kind of told that history, you know, and where Stokely was on the West Coast, and how Algiers Cleaver at that time was was working for Ramparts, and the whole way you weave that story to give us the history of how this began and the complexity of it between not just Stokely and the Panthers, but SNCC and the Panthers. I mean, this is a very critical point for Stokely and for the Black movement, for the civil rights movement.
Yeah, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, that's still a story that people kind of quite don't understand,
right.
even though the iconography of that story is all around us, right? And in 2016 will be the 40th anniversary of the Panthers, the 50th anniversary of the Panthers. And what's interesting with Stokely's relationship, one, he helps found the original Black Panther Party, which is a political party in Lowndes County, Alabama. Now, through an activist named Mark Comfort, who had been in Lowndes, Mark Comfort brings back some of the paraphernalia and the literature of Lowndes to Oakland, to Bobby Seale and to Huey P. Newton. And, you know, Huey's 24 years old, Bobby's 30. They're both itinerant activists and part-time troublemakers. The Panther symbol had spread nationally even before Huey and Bobby start their own Panther chapter. There's footage of Dr. King in July in Chicago, and people are carrying signs that say Black Panther Party, right? And it's not just they're from Lowndes County, Alabama. They're just saying, hey, they're going to start it in Chicago. Activists like Max Stanford of the Revolutionary Action Movement, Muhammad Ahmed, had organized with Stokely to try to start Black Panther political parties in places like Harlem. So the Panther symbol was hugely resonant for activists, not just in the urban North, but in the South, in the West Coast, in 1966. So what Bobby and Huey do is really take that symbol and run with it, and they also cultivate a relationship with Stokely as early as 66. So Stokely is going to different Black Power conferences, some which are organized by Molana Karenga, who is another major Black Power activist and who founded the organization US. US as opposed to them, not United Slaves, as the FBI had claimed and others have claimed. And what's interesting is, you know, Karenga founds the Holiday Kwanzaa, the whole notion of, you know, when people think about cultural nationalism and a return to Africa, return to the source, is coming from that strain. Stokely is friends and allies with all those folks. So, you know, he's there with Karenga. Huey and Bobby are friendly with him. And what really happens is that as Stokely's iconography continues to grow, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense tries to really latch on to that iconography. They draft him into the party. That's executive mandate number two in the summer of 1967. While he's on his way to London, he's being drafted as a field marshal
right.
into the Black Panther Party. And what's interesting is the Panthers are trying to court Eldridge Cleaver. Cleaver initially is really not interested in them until there's the Ramparts confrontation between Huey and police when they're escorting Betty Shabazz into the Ramparts. San Francisco offices in February of 1967. Cleaver is really interested in Stokely Carmichael. You know, thing that's very interesting in investigating their relationship is that Cleaver tries to travel overseas with Stokely. Cleaver is following Stokely all through the winter and spring of 67 for an article in Ramparts magazine that's eventually called My Father and Stokely Carmichael, where Cleaver is very, very laudatory about Stokely. Stokely becomes Cleaver's hero, and Stokely used to quip after the article came out that the real title of the article should have been My Father, comma, Stokely Carmichael. And that's what, because yeah. Stokely becomes the prime minister and the godfather of all these different kind of militants that are springing up, whether it's Rap Brown or Eldridge Cleaver, certainly there's Malcolm X, but Stokely is the person they're immediately seeing, and they're completely, completely in awe of, right? So when it comes to the Panthers, by the time Stokely comes back from that five-month tour of the world, the Panthers then beseech Stokely to speak at their Free Huey rallies, because Huey Newton has been arrested for shooting a police officer. He says it's in self-defense, and he's on trial for murder, and he's facing the gas chamber, and that happens in October of 67, while Stokely is actually in Tanzania. That's happening, Tanzania or Guinea. So what's interesting with the Panthers is that it's really Stokely Carmichael on February 17th and 18th, by making him prime minister, by trying to do this alliance with SNCC, where Rap Brown becomes Minister of Justice, informing gets a title as well. That's what really makes the Panthers into this national phenomenon. That you've got Stokely Carmichael, who's the best known black radical revolutionary on the planet at the time, saying he's going to be prime minister. You got Eldridge Cleaver, who's more of a regional figure, but Soul on Ice is going to sell 2 million over the next 2 years, although Cleaver is going to flee the United States in November of 68. So he's on the scene, the American scene, for less than 2 years, Eldridge Cleaver. From the time he's paroled from prison in December of 66, he's in Cuba by the end of right. 1968. So that's very interesting to note, too. So Stokely really puts that thread through. He's the person who popularizes the Panthers, and not just black power, but this idea that there can be homegrown revolutionaries right here in the United States.
So on our way to talking about Sekou Touré and this next huge stage in Stokely Carmichael's life, I have several questions, but I'll come back. I want to get to this one point, though. I don't want to forget it. See, what you posit in this book, really, I mean, throughout it, is that something that hasn't been said before, I think, is how key a figure Stokely Carmichael was to the civil rights movement, to the nationalist movement, to the revolutionary movement in America in the 1960s, as key, it sounds like you're writing, in many ways, as Martin Luther King or Malcolm X.
Yes, absolutely. That's right? The argument. My argument is that when we think about the 60s, and that's why I call him the last icon of the 60s, one which, unlike Martin and Malcolm, people haven't written dozens and dozens, hundreds of books and articles about, and documentaries and movies and all the like about, to explore their iconography and their historical legacy and how it reverberated nationally and globally and locally. Stokely, yes, he's part of that triumvirate. And, you know, he has his mistakes, his shortcomings, but in terms of his sheer impact on the world stage, he actually belongs in that same company. So he's more than just a black power revolutionary. He's more than a revolutionary Pan-Africanist. He's more than just a civil rights leader. He's really this protean activist and intellectual and organizer and mobilizer for the 1960s and beyond. But his impact is huge and still understudied and sort of underanalyzed, whether it's the impact on, you know, Vietnam, the impact on Dr. King, the impact on the Black Panthers, the impact on community organizing, the impact on Mississippi, Alabama, sharecroppers, the relationships, you know, whether it's Fidel Castro or Fannie Lou Hamer or Ella Baker, Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, a really, really protean figure who adopts so many different roles in his lifetime. But the one that's very, very consistent is this one of being a revolutionary. And so he's incredibly important, yet you know, people relegate him to, you know, sort of the margins of this period as somebody who
right.
you know, said this phrase and then you know is no longer relevant.
I mean, and you just gave lineage right there, and so I'm curious, I'm very curious. What launched this for you? I mean, what launched this understanding of Stokely? What was the thing that sparked that said, "Well, we've forgotten this figure. This is none of us knew this." I mean, what sparked that?
Well, I think it was my research into the Black Power movement and writing my first book, which you know utilized Malcolm X, Stokely, Amiri Baraka, you know Gloria Richardson, Angela Davis, these different figures, Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver. Just to try to get to a deeper understanding of what the Black Power movement was. And one of the things I found out through doing that research was that Black Power was more than just sort of angry young militants. It involved anti-war protesters. It involved people who were connected to the National Welfare Rights Organization, tenants' rights, bread and butter issues at the local level that then congealed into sort of these national expressions, you know, Black studies, Black elected officials, the Black arts movement. And then there was a global side to it in the way in which this rhetoric of Black power impacted, let's say, Stephen Biko in South Africa, the Black consciousness movement, or Caribbean radicals, let's say, Walter Rodney in Guyana. You know, so it was very, very interesting to figure that all out. And what in the course of doing that research, I saw where Malcolm X fit into that. But I was surprised at the numerous times that Stokely Carmichael fit into that. So I think that doing that kind of research, you saw Stokely, you know, in Mississippi, in Alabama, in Montreal, with C.L.R. James at the Dialectics Liberation Conference in London, with Allen Ginsberg, right, with Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, Fidel right. Castro. I mean, seeing all this, Shirley Graham Du Bois in China, going to Vietnam and having lunch with Ho Chi Minh, I mean, this was astonishing.
You know, because you're writing about when you made the litany of other people, there are many people who were stars of the civil rights movement and stars of the movement, but he was pivotal. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. He's absolutely pivotal. So what's interesting is he's got this global iconography, and certainly he is. You know, I've written that he's Black Power's rock star, and not in a dismissive way, but to say that there is something incredibly sexy and incredibly attractive about him in the context of the late 1960s, and he becomes sort of a magazine cover boy and poster boy. He becomes this matinee idol. He cannot walk anywhere without crowds of people gathering on him, whether he's at historically Black or white colleges. I mean, he's on Face the Nation, Meet the Press. He's on the Nightly News. He's writing essays in the New Republic and the New York Review of Books and being profiled in the New York Times Magazine. I mean, this person in the late 60s, he's a bigger presence globally, and his politics are resonating more while he's alive as a young man than Malcolm X in Malcolm X's lifetime, because much of the reverberation about Malcolm X, it happens after he's assassinated. You know, and we can see that from just even the coverage while he's alive of his international exploits, both in 59 and the trips in 64, they pale in comparison to the coverage of Stokely Carmichael's exploits, because what's going on is that he's being looked upon by both the media, FBI, State Department, COINTELPRO, President of the United States demands twice weekly reports. He's impacting politics as they go. So with Stokely, it's not so much as just simply a prophetic voice, but it's a voice that's impacting, you know, the war in Vietnam. It's impacting civil rights activism and civil rights bill, Black power activism, all while he's in the moment. So it's a very interesting story to see how it unfolds, because he's so pivotally impacting everything.
So what do you think it was that Stokely's legacy did not live, in a sense, as did King's or Malcolm's? But you could say the same about other people. You could say the same about Ella Baker. You could say the same about Rosa Parks, maybe. But I'm saying there are many others. But what is it about? What do you think happened that his legacy didn't kind of shine the same way?
Well, I think, one, he was not martyred. You know, you think about Malcolm and Martin, they're both martyred at 39
obviously,
years old.
Right,
they're both
right,
assassinated.
Right.
So he does not die young. I mean, I think if Stokely Carmichael has been killed by the the end of the 60s, he would have been as big of an icon now as Malcolm X. He would have been perceived as, you know, there would have been some funeral, there would have been outrage, and people would have said, you know, what might have he become? I also think leaving to Africa, the alliances he creates in Africa, very, very specific. Some people are very, very critical of those alliances with Sekou Touré, Kwame Nkrumah, a very specific vision of Pan-Africanism, scientific socialism. Changing his name to Kwame Touré when the person who had gotten the iconography of the United States was named Stokely Carmichael. All those things, remaining an unapologetic revolutionary and political radical, even in the context of Reaganism and Thatcherism and neoliberalism, remaining ready for revolution. So all those things have helped really place him on the margins of this history.
And let's go to what created the Sekou Touré and his leaving America. He never came back and spent a full year here after he left, as you write.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, I think in the context of the late 60s, Stokely and many Black Power activists were looking for answers to how they could, you know, defeat American imperialism, how they could combat racial oppression, economic injustice, war. There was a prison crisis then that exploded since then, but people were talking about prisoner rights even then. And so, you know, when we think about the Black Power movement, many activists, and I think Stokely was on the leading edge of this, said they were going to become revolutionary Pan-Africanists. And part of this was because of so many different important revolutionary struggles happening in Africa. So we're thinking about people like Amilcar Cabral and the PAIGC. We're thinking about Samora Machel and Frelimo. We're thinking about struggles in Angola. We're thinking about Julius Nyerere and Ujamaa in Tanzania. So these things, you know, the ANC, people like Stokely knew who Nelson Mandela was and about the ANC. He'd gone to Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, and met with people from the different revolutionary movements. And these folks were in Conakry, too. So in that context, Africa seemed to be just really an important site for anti-colonial, anti-imperial struggle. And because African revolutionaries were often divided themselves, if you were an American or somebody who was outside of Africa, you had to come sort of survey the land and then choose sides. And that's what Stokely did, Kwame Touré. And the side he picked was Conakry. He picked Guinea. And part of that has to do with the fact that Nkrumah was there. I think in a huge way it's because Nkrumah was there. It also has to do with, you know, Miriam Makeba, his wife. You know, they settle into Guinea. They have direct and intimate access to the president and his wife, President Touré. So from that context, it all makes perfect sense, even though there's going to be fallout. And once you make those choices and you're saying this is the only way to go, your politics are not going to be as expansive and flexible as they were previously.
And he was, when he was there, he played really an interesting role because he went to actually work with Kwame Nkrumah, thought that it was part of his doing his analysis for him, and as you write and talk about how to reinstall him as the Prime Minister of Ghana. I mean, he wasn't just playing around in Africa. He was creating also this international black political movement that he founded.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the politics there are real. They're just not going to be necessarily as effective as he had hoped. So up until Nkrumah's death in 1972, he's serving as personal secretary. They're trying to get Nkrumah back in office in Ghana. And then from 72 to 84, you know, he's part of the Ghanaian Democratic Party. He becomes part of the Touré political government. I mean, so he's really right there with the All-African People's Revolutionary Party trying to organize for revolutionary Pan-Africanism, both in Africa, but certainly on tours of the United States and other parts of the world as well.
So I'm curious, when in writing this book, you chose the call it Stokely and not Kwame.
Yeah, I think that when we think about, for a couple of reasons. One, I think his iconography, people know him or
as
recognize
Stokely.
Him
right.
as Stokely.
Right.
And two, I think that the African story, we still need more sources in the sense of there are no open sources to the African archives and sort of a day-to-day account of what happened with him during the 30 years in Africa. So I think that I called it Stokely for that reason, even though by the time he's publicly being called Kwame Ture in 78-79, in the narrative, it switches over to Kwame Ture. In the epilogue, I look at, from Stokely Carmichael to Kwame Ture, and, what does that mean? And what is that, why did that happen? And what does it mean for his legacy?
I mean, it's interesting because you have the line in here, which is very striking. We talked about this a bit earlier about Stokely Carmichael's place in the iconography of revolutionary and civil rights leaders. You write that during the last 2 years of King's life, he was the dominant national and international political figure, dominated national international politics. I mean that his role at the end of King's life and his role in when he lived in Africa continued to kind of build. I mean, he was in and out of America all the time, traveling to other countries, still speaking. He never stopped.
No, he never stopped. I mean, so he loses the political celebrity in the United States, but there's still an aura of celebrity that surrounds him about, in terms of people who are in the know, like people who are activists. Wherever he goes, there's still, a huge entourage and people who know him as Stokely Carmichael, now Kwame Ture. So the political activism and organizing never stops. It's just that the impact that he had as Stokely Carmichael was just so far-reaching, right? It was just so global. And then as Kwame Ture, he becomes such he's more of a revolutionary political ideologue, right? So it's a very specific line that he's espousing in terms of organizing this global Pan-African revolution, and it's not going to attract the same kind of intense support and followers, but he's still going to retain his love of political struggle and his real deep-seated belief that, revolution was going to happen, that the contradictions of American imperialism, capitalism, inequality were going to be too much, and that revolution one day, even if he didn't live to see it, was going to happen.
One thing we haven't talked yet, Peniel, we have to put in here, is we have not talked about Miriam Makeba and his marriage to Miriam Makeba.
Yeah, Miriam Makeba is very, very interesting and very important because he's married to her for 10 years,
right.
And in a way, not only does it fulfill a lifelong fantasy, but it really introduces him and really sets the stage for him to become Kwame Ture, this sort of international Pan-African revolutionary, because Miriam Makeba is a bigger global celebrity than him. She opens up a number of different doors, and it really adds to his status as this celebrated icon. As a couple, they are, especially end of the 60s, early 70s, an enormously jet-setting, glamorous couple. So, Miriam Makeba can have access to really any embassy in the world, including any embassy in Africa except, the South African embassy because of racial apartheid, which is their homeland. So she's very, very important, very, very influential. Now, his politics hurts her career, so that's certainly going to cause some kind of tensions over time. Because the fact that she's married to this revolutionary, especially in the United States, so that's some part of the reason of leaving has to do with the fact that she can get much more engagements overseas and in Europe than she can in the United States once she's married to Stokely Carmichael.
When you write about this relationship he had with Martin Luther King and other diverse political leaders that he got along with and didn't necessarily always agree with politically on every issue. I mean, you're talking about a man who is the consummate organizer who knows how to build a movement. And this is a lesson for people today about how you build a movement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One thing he does in 1968 when he comes back from his international trip, Stokely tries to start a Black United Front. And he tries to include, diverse ideological perspectives, including Black conservatives, liberals, moderates, but also radicals and revolutionaries. So I think that his relationship with King was really a great example in terms of coalition politics, how you build a movement, and also how you can have real personal relationships with people despite political differences, right? So it wasn't a zero-sum game for Stokely in those days and in that context. You know, and he really respects King and sort of understands King's huge, massive importance to the movement, which is, I think, one of the reasons why he's so bereft after King is assassinated, because he understands that there's been a hole that's been put that can't, you know, no one can replace King, however much they try. So I do think it's about movement building and organizing that friendship and the realization that they both need each other. There's a yin and yang there where they both need each other, and there's even places that they find common ground, like on Vietnam.
Pinot Joseph, I want to thank you so much. This has been an amazing book that you wrote, and I just want to thank you for writing it and for sharing it with the world. And this is an important legacy for us all to rest with. Stokely Life by Pinot Joseph.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.